Welcome to the Middletown Podcast. I'm Kat Hughes, I'm a research officer with Middletown, and I'm also autistic. In this episode, I chat to Amanda McGuinness. Amanda is an autism advocate who does fantastic work as a training officer with As I Am and through her own work on Little Puddins. She has gorgeous illustrations and a blog on Little Puddins, where she shares her experiences as an autistic person and a parent. I was very excited to chat to her about her experiences as a late identified autistic woman and her brilliant advocacy work. Thank you so much, Amanda, for joining me on the podcast. I wanted to start by asking you, could you describe your younger self?
I think about what I think of my younger self. I always think about what I loved to do. And that would have been, I just, as it is probably now looking around my room, I just loved research and I loved learning. And I was always trying to learn something new or figure out something new. So I can remember from being really, really small, just having this sense of I just need to find out that piece of information, whatever it was. And I was lucky, I suppose, in that the house I grew up in, I'm one of 11, but I was very lucky in that my dad in particular, in hindsight, like when he would have read my, I'd say, adult autism assessment, you know, sorry, I use the word of self-identification, that, you know, the paperwork that said you were definitely autistic. When he read that, he was like, God, I do that. And sure, that's just like me. He goes, sure, I think I could be autistic. And I'm like, I think you could be, Dad. You know, but again, I'm not identifying anybody like as in diagnosing. But I just remember having this really strong sense of wanting to be like my dad, but also feeling very safe, obviously, with my mom as well. But in particular, in my household, that even though I used to have a strong sense of I just had this strong urge to constantly learn things. And people might have said precocious or different things about me, and I don't think they said it negatively, but it was that I just was constantly asking questions and I was constantly looking for information, constantly climbing on the units. And I remember we had like these mahogany, I think everyone had them in the 80s and the 90s, mahogany bookshelves, and be climbing up there and then getting into trouble for basically nearly knocking over the television that back in the day looked like a massive chunk of concrete. It was the old style like it was a good thing to stand on though if you were short and trying to reach a bookshelf. But I just always remember I found a lot of the world really confusing. And I think because I had the sense of the world outside of books, and I mean outside of my home, very confusing. And I used to feel like I kept getting things wrong. So I kept feeling like if I learned enough information, although what, like it was in the Britannia, like it probably wasn't the information I needed for the social world, like something about a fly or some engineering fact. But I kept feeling like if I could learn all the information, I could make it stay in my brain. And then when I go out into the social world, although I wouldn't have said the social world, I would have said the world outside the door. I could then figure it all out for that piece because I just couldn't make it make sense. So for me, I always just remember being small and just wanting to learn as much as I could at home, because at home was obviously very safe. And then when I would go out into the world, if I could just bring that information that I could learn at home into the social world, then it would make sense. But I do remember always feeling like, I don't know, do you ever feel like this, Kat? But like if someone is explaining something to me or I'm in a conversation, I feel like I can't see clearly because my mind is trying to quickly flick through all the imagery in my brain and try to place the piece so I can connect what they're saying to, say, my files of information or like my cinematic kind of mind. I feel like I'm not able to clearly see for a moment while I'm trying to very quickly see inside my mind. And I'm trying to place what they're saying into like some kind of information in my head so I can be like, oh, that's what they mean. But often I end up getting myself a migraine because I don't have that lived experience that, say, a non-autistic person might have. Or again, the social world for me is still very confusing. So I often used to feel like I used to feel very confused often. And then I used to have this thing of, oh, you're just not a good enough person. So I do remember being young, trying so, so hard, probably still do it as an adult, but trying so, so hard to be a good enough person this time. And if I was a good enough person this time, I'd be accepted into that friends group, or I would finally figure out the thing that everyone else seemed to know about, say, like, for example, when I was a little bit older than, say, a teenager, I remember going to, a friend said, do you want to go to a disco? I was like, yeah. And it was in like this, I'm from the country, but it was a real country area. And I was saying, what do you wear? And she was like, wear something comfortable. I was like, okay, I'll wear something comfortable. And I was thinking immediately, do you remember the O'Neill tracksuit bottoms? And I'm much older than you, so they may not have been around. I feel vintage, so they were definitely vintage. And they were like these navy tracksuit bottoms. And I had this lovely woolly jumper that granny had given me, like, you know, the knitted, if you think of the Aran Islands, an Aran jumper. I said, God, I feel so comfortable. This is great. I'm going to wear this. And then my sister, who is an absolute saint, Claudia, was saying, I don't think you should wear that. This is a disco. I was like, they said comfortable. And I used to read the thesaurus. I said, I know what comfortable means, like, hello. So off I went to the disco dressed like someone that was ready for the farm. And everyone was clearly wearing like very little clothes and high shoes. And she was like, what are you wearing? And I was like, you said comfortable. She was like, this is what I mean. And I was like, oh God. So for me, I always remember I had to keep double checking everything everyone said. Now, it was a big joke and everyone laughed and all the thing. But in the long run, like, I still think of it today, not in all my life and the trauma, but just God, there was a moment where I got things wrong. So for me, I just from very, very young, I was researching, trying to understand the world. And interestingly, I think like one of the things I did when I started to get pocket money when I was really small is I used to buy thesauruses and I would read all the words associated with different words so that I would try them when people were speaking to understand clearly what they meant because I couldn't really figure it out. Again, now I know because I take language so literally. And even I was speaking to somebody earlier just to do with my work and I was saying, oh, just to clarify, because I understand language very literally, is this what you mean? And then like I can do that now. But back in the day, I didn't know. But that's why. So for me, I can distinctly remember buying. I remember my first thesaurus was like a Collins's like dictionary thesaurus. And there's this little pocket one. So I used to bring it everywhere. And it was all highlighted with yellow and underlined. So I'd be like, that's what they mean when they say the thing. And then I later actually went on to have an English degree because I was so obsessed with, I wouldn't say obsessed, but so interested in words and English and reading. So it kind of all, I suppose, brought me to where I am today with my still, I suppose, interest and obsession with language and words. And my question I used to always just say is, but what does that mean? You know, what does that mean? So because I wanted to always make sure I got it right this time. So for me, my younger years were just researching, trying to figure out the world. But I suppose I didn't have the knowledge that I have now as an adult going, well, if I just tilted the lens a little bit more to the right, then that would be the knowledge base that I needed. Instead, I was like reading whatever the books we had, you know, the books that everyone had back in the 80s and 90s, the encyclopedias. It was still good information, but it wasn't really helpful in the way that I needed it. And then that obviously led me on then, I suppose, to still even now today, it's kind of I'm an older version of my younger self. I still avoid social outings and things where I can, but I'm still massively interested in researching and learning all the wonderful things that there are in the world to learn. So
that feeling of sort of the search for clarity when you're young and not even knowing, not really knowing what clarity would even look like or feel like, but also kind of just knowing that you need it and feeling out of step, I think, is so relatable.
Yeah, but I also feel like misplaced, but I didn't have the language or the understanding of misplaced, but I just knew there was something, but I didn't know what it was.
Yeah. And but how lovely. And I would have had sort of a similar experience where at home I was in this little bubble where my behavior and my way of understanding things was pretty normal. And very kind of accepted. And it was then when I stepped out the door that I had to kind of go, okay, what does everyone mean here? And I think it is, I feel really lucky to have had that.
Same. Yeah, I think that the biggest thing my parents will often say to me, because I suppose I am a parent myself to four incredible children, three of whom were autistic. They'll often say, well, like, what's really important to do or to know? And I always just think it's just really important to support your child as authentically as they are. That would have and did help me massively. Like my dad would have given me, he was a builder, he's retired now, would have given me a key to his office. And he would just, because obviously I was one of 11, I was the eldest girl. He would say, when it gets too busy for you, Amanda, just you have the key now. And he couldn't have the 11 of us in his office because it was his workspace. He would just say, you just come in here and lock the door and just sit down at the desk there. He'd be off on the building sites. And he would just, but do it. I broke his printer so many times and he never, I used to like thinking I was going to like, I used to like draw on them as well. And I put them through the printer trying to print them in different colors and didn't always work. I used to jam it a lot. But he never blamed me or ever said, were you, he said it to me years later. He goes, geez, he said, I know you'd break the printer on me, but I just say, she likes to be figuring out how to use it. And I wouldn't have been the height of the printer, it would have been a business printer back in the day, you know, those real tall ones. Mm-hmm. But for me, that was one of the important things that made me feel like who I was accepted at home for who I was. Just my brothers and sisters will be outside in the summer playing, like I would say back the fields, like we lived in the country, so everywhere was like summer to play, but they'd be playing back the fields and I'd be walking around the house with like a notepad and taking notes. And I didn't know what I was writing, but I was busy doing whatever it was that I was doing, but I was being encouraged to do that. That's it. There was nobody saying, put down the pen and paper and go outside and run around after a plastic ball. It was do whatever you wanted to do. And like, so for me, that was really important. But I think the thing that I wish did exist back then, which thankfully does now, thanks to incredible people like yourself and our wonderful CEO and as I am, Adam Harris, is that representation. I didn't have that growing up and I didn't see anyone like me. And it was as safe as you just said, as safe as I was at home to be me. That was fantastic. And as a parent, my parents encouraged me to be myself. But the difficulty for me was that when I went out into society and went out into school, and in particular secondary school, and even I suppose, you know, primary school, there was nobody like me, and there was nobody for me to look up to, and there was nobody for me to see. I just think as a parent, if I was starting out today, obviously I know about yourself and all the incredible work that you do. And then obviously as I am, I just think it's so important that we can look and say, well, how do I help my child? And the first thing I always say to parents is that representation matters. It's important that your child sees, say, autistic-led organizations, goes to fantastic speakers like your wonderful self, Kat, and listen to lived experience. And then even as a parent, for myself, even I heard you speaking at the As I Am conference recently, I could so connect with so much of what you were saying, but I could also see elements of Jack and Connor and Max's story in what you were saying, and all of the wonderful, every speaker, but in particular the autistic speakers, I could see elements of, it just rang so true. When I think about when I was saying earlier about as a child, like, or someone speaking to me, trying to see, even though I was trying to see clearly, even though I could see clearly, but I was trying to flick quickly through in my mind, I just think that if I had that back then, and even now as an adult, it's so, so important. That that's one of the things that I always say to parents, is that always keep in your mind that autistic representation, it really matters that your children see themselves. Like, it's so important that we are guided by, for our children, that we are guided by autistic individuals, because that is, as much as, you know, I'd like to say, you know, I'd like to think I could guide Hayley in what it's like to be neurotypical. I know I can't authentically do that. I can give her great advice, and she's got fantastic aunties and uncles and grannies and granddads and all of that. But ultimately, I'll never be neurotypical. So I can read about it. I do read about it. I try to understand it. I'm like, oh, that would make sense. Why that didn't work out for me. Say, as a teen, those teenage books about growing up as a teenager, I'm like, oh, well, okay, well, that, I wish I had read that book myself personally, because I would have understood the neurotypical world. But as a parent, I feel like in our household, it's a little bit different, because I flip the narrative around what I'm trying to understand, because the majority of my household is autistic. And the neuro minority, I suppose we'd say, is my daughter. I don't say unfortunately, but for her, that everyone else in the household really is autistic. So for me, it's, I feel like I have that empathy for parents who are trying to understand their autistic children, because I have to do it myself for my daughter in a totally different way. I try to understand the neurotypical world, and that's why it's brilliant for her. There is so much representation. So for me, for the autistic kids, and for myself as a young person growing up, that would have changed everything if I had been able to, like, go to the likes of As I Am autistic led. Do you know what I mean?
Absolutely. And I, like, for myself, when I got my diagnosis, the first thing I did was look for a support group. At the time, it was autistic women that I wanted to look for a support group. I think I'd be much more sort of open-minded now if I were looking for one, but and there wasn't one, so I set one up. And that was kind of how I sort of got into the world of sort of advocacy in that, because I just sort of felt like I just needed to know other autistic people and to see what their experiences were like. And then meeting other autistic people just sort of blew my mind, because I suddenly, you know, there were so many people who had such similar experiences to me.
Yeah, and like, for me, I remember, like, so for Connor is almost 14, I remember, like, at different times. Again, kind of what I always did was, when Connor was identified as autistic, and this is back almost 14 years ago, there wasn't like, even the internet, now I lived in Mayo, could have been the Mayo issue, but there wasn't great internet, and there wasn't, like, you couldn't just type in, and even the information you could find online was very strange around autism. And then the books you would buy, I have a book actually in, so I have a homeschool room off at my office here, and it's basically every book you can ever imagine that was probably written on autism. I most likely, if I think it's a good book, I have it, or if I read it and I was like, yeah, it's not for me, I donate it to a library because I think it might be helpful for somebody. But one book I remember buying and keeping, and I must dig it out someday, was a book that said, when your child has the autism. And that was the only book I could find in a bookshop at the time, and I said, what does this mean, and what does it, and it was so scary the way everything was written. I was thinking, but that's not my son, this is not my son. And all the books that I could find at that time were really negative. And then I remember Jack then was born, and then I was, I suppose, very aware that he was autistic, I felt, but again, at that point I didn't have the knowledge base that I have now. But then I remember again watching I don't know, I always talk about Adam, he's like, my God, stop. But like, I remember seeing Adam speaking to, I think it was Brendan O'Connor, is that his name, on a show on RTE. And I just remember listening to him, and I was like, this is what I've been saying, not what he was saying, but I was saying, this is how I understand my children, that they are the most incredible, authentic, amazing human beings. And here's this autistic young man on television talking about his lived experience. But then I found connections and what he was saying with my own life, because he was saying it's like being an alien on a different like planet. And I was like, oh, well, that's kind of how I have felt, but I don't know. So between my researching for Connor to understand autism and finding like there was elements of truth in some of the information, like it might be a sentence in a really strange paragraph, the way they spoke about autism, I found it very like not exactly right. But I remember hearing Adam speak. And that's where that's the first time that I'd heard about As I Am. And I remember thinking, my God, that's what we need in the country, is an autistic led organization. But also as a parent at the time, not realizing I was yet to realize that I was autistic. But for me, it meant that I was guided by a person that was so able to educate on lived experience, but obviously so academic himself and so capable. And as I know, years since, just so fantastically and just the most wonderful human being, to be able to listen to a person like that just made me think, there is another way to understand what it is to have an autistic child. And it is the way that I didn't have the words yet to understand myself as a human being, as an autistic person, but it meant I had a new way to understand my son, Connor. And it meant that it aligned with my thoughts and feelings for my children as a parent. And it meant that as I was trying to do, as my dad and parents had done for me, was that they wanted me to be my authentic self. And the advice that I was reading in books and the internet on autism were so negative. But yet here was Adam Harris, a young man, still a young man, but a much younger man at the time, talking on like a national television program about his lived experience as an autistic person. And I just remember thinking, my God, everybody. I remember at the time my Facebook page was very small. I remember putting up this post and a screenshot going, oh my God, and I need to, I wish I could, like, you know, my Facebook memories give you like the memories of your personal page. I wish I did it for like blog pages, because it doesn't, because I'd love it to come up and I'd be like, I told you I did this like over 10 years ago, almost 10 years ago. And I remember putting up going, my God, did anyone hear this man? You know, hopefully one day my gorgeous Jack and my beautiful Connor will grow up and maybe even meet this incredible. And actually, they very luckily did. Adam came to Mayo a number of months ago and visited the boys' school. It was just, as you can imagine, fantastic. And I just thought, wow, little did I know back then that this person that so inspired me would one day, you know, I would one day get to work with him, let alone even just meet him alone would be enough, but that my own kids would get to meet him. But for me, that would be the thing. I think I always come back to that representation is so, so important. Did you feel that yourself?
Absolutely. Yeah. Life changing, to be honest.
Yeah, isn't it?
Yeah, I really think it is. Because we just don't see, there's only stereotypes that are shown to us.
Yes.
And I don't relate to them for the most part. But then when I meet autistic people, it's suddenly, aside from there just being an ease in terms of how I communicate, because we
were just chatting over and back. Do you know, I know it's a podcast, but it's just like talking, this isn't strange, but talking to myself, because we totally understand, or even if we're saying about like language differences or processing differences, we totally get it.
That's it. Exactly. You've sort of talked about how, you know, you loved learning and you were a real sort of enthusiast for finding new information. Yes. How did you enjoy your school life then? Did that sort of help with that?
It actually was quite easy for me in school as far as academics went. So like at the moment, for example, I'm undertaking a master's in speech and language in the university in Galway. And the biggest difficulty that I've had, so I'm doing it over 2 years just because I have little ones and trying to juggle it all. So I'm doing it part time. And the biggest difficulty I've had is actually just the time. I don't find, now touch wood, I could like massively fail and I'd be like, delete that podcast. But so far, but again, it is down again to my incredible lecturers as well, and the way that the whole course is taught. But I haven't found any of it difficult. I have just found the time difficult, because I just don't have enough time. So I feel like the juggling of the time is difficult. But the academia never, like school was never, the school, the academic side of school was never difficult for me. The thing that was difficult for me was like the schoolyard or figuring out what friendships. And again, even now, like I remember a number of years ago, somebody said to me in passing, you know, there's like acquaintances and there's like friends, and then and I was like, what? I just this is like, and again, I've like a BA, I have a bachelor's in law, I'm almost, touch wood, if I don't fail it, and after saying it's been so, I don't say easy, but like accessible for me anyway, like for someone that is so academic and so research minded, it never occurred, again, never occurred to me that not everyone is your close friend. I mean, I understood that the postman wasn't my close friend, but it never just occurred to me that in friendship circles, and now it does now, because I'm like, okay, you have to remember this. It's something I have to remind myself of, that not everyone is, and not in a bad way, not in a bad way at all, but like there's different levels of friendships and different levels of who you might say, like, I burnt the jelly at Christmas, even though you're like, how can you do that? And I'd be like, I actually burnt custards and a trifle. So there's different people you would tell your foibles to. And then there's people you might tell more of. Do you know the kind of, and then people you don't tell, like the postman, I wouldn't be like, did I let you know I burnt actually the trifle at Christmas? He'd be like, oh, and here's your letter. I'd be like, thank you so much. So like for me, the difficulty with school, and again, I was very lucky. I went to a lovely primary school called Derry Wash, which was a small, now it's much bigger now, it's really grown. It's fantastic. I went to a small primary school in the west of Ireland. So again, lovely friendship group, small circle of friends. But again, where everybody else, even in secondary school, was into going out and doing all the things, I never really was. And again, and to no fault of my own, I was interested in what I was interested in, and that was reading and researching. But then that didn't go so well for, you know, people that did like to go out and go to like meet up in town. I remember lots of being asked loads of times to go to different things with people, and I'd go the odd time. And then I know now I'd be burnt out afterwards, but I'd be like, God, that was okay. But now I feel so unwell. I know now that's burnout, but I didn't know what that was at the time. So for me, the difficulty with school was really navigating the social world. I remember if, say, my certain friends weren't in on a day, I just hang out in the loo at lunchtime, which isn't ideal. But I didn't know what I was supposed to do, and I didn't know how to, like, I don't say break into another friendship group, because we're very lucky in secondary school. Everyone was generally just very friendly and kind to each other. I suppose, thankfully, it was pre-social media, so you wouldn't find your foibles up on social media for the rest of your life. So it was really just, you know, I had lots of awkward moments and like misunderstandings, but I was just, again, lucky. I was just probably one of the, I don't sound like it was terrible for everyone, I probably was though one of the lucky people, that I was just lucky. I was, and again, I'm one of 11, so I always had loads of brothers and sisters in school, so I wasn't ever without, if that makes sense. But I wouldn't really say that. Like, for example, when I was in fifth year, my dad said, when I completed fifth year, because I loved Galway, still love Galway, he said, you know, you can go to the Yates College, was the name of it. There was a private school in Galway, like a boarding school. He said, if you'd like to, because you love researching, he goes, if you do really well this year for yourself in fifth year, I'll send you to Galway, to the private school for next year for your Leaving Cert. And I loved it. Oh my God, I loved that. I was allowed to do as many subjects as I wanted for the Leaving Cert. So I did like 10 or 11. I took up like biology that year, because I hadn't, my timetable in secondary school for a fifth year wouldn't allow it. So I took up biology, and could have been economics. I was, this is fantastic, more knowledge. And I did very well, which is thankfully so. But again, what I loved was you're in college or school, what they call it, college all day till I think it was three or four. I'm going to say three, half three. No, secondary school, so it would have been four. We went home to our digs or wherever you're staying for your dinner. You came back in from 6 till 10. So all I did was study. So that was probably my favorite year ever in school, because there was no chance of me making an absolute social catastrophe, as I often call myself, because there was nobody had time. You were literally studying. So that's what I did, and I loved it. And again, it gave me a great learning to be independent, because what it meant then was, what I realized looking back, I probably should say, is that I never had a difficulty moving on to the next whatever, because although I had friends, in hindsight, they were lovely people. And I even met a lady a number of weeks ago in a restaurant, haven't seen her since secondary school. She would have been one of my friends, but just through life, you just go to college in different places. But again, I had great friends, but I didn't mind leaving to go on to the next. There was always an adventure to learn more information. Whereas another person might be like, I can't leave my friends, I will stay and I don't need to. I'd be like, yes, I'd love to live in Galway, away from my whole family. I'd love to go on, like, you know, I suppose adventuring. I'd go into Salt Hill in the evenings for a walk before I go back to college for the Earth School, it was called college, for the evenings. I loved it. So for me, because I was autistic, that benefited me going to that school, because it meant then I learned so much about intense researching, which helped me then for university, and then which obviously ultimately helped me as a parent now for my own kids.
That's incredible. I love hearing about a gorgeous school experience.
Yeah.
Because talking to people, I haven't heard that many of them, because I think there's a lot of people that I've talked to for the podcast who were diagnosed in adulthood and so really, really struggled in school. So that's just lovely.
Well, the difficulty for me, I suppose, would have been navigating the social world. But do you know what I say? And I always say this. So if I'm so like at the conference when I was delivering I was with the absolutely wonderful Peter Remulan. I'm never nervous when I deliver a presentation, because I cannot read one face in the room, and I couldn't tell you, like, you could be absolutely bored now. And I do apologize if you're, I cannot tell if somebody is bored, and I cannot tell if someone thinks it's great, a presentation. I cannot tell. I cannot read a face. I look at the eyebrows. I'm like, sometimes if the eyebrows do the downward, it means someone's angry, but I cannot read a face. So what probably benefited me then more than anything in school is that it nearly protected me, that I couldn't say something. Maybe school was horrendous, but I was like, yeah, it was a great place. Like everything, like it wasn't actually, was, I have to say nobody, I was always more or less very lucky. But for me, I think because I just socially cannot read what's going on around me, that I was like, yeah, it seemed to be pretty good. That might not have been the case. I'll never know, but I thought it was okay, you know. I got on fine, more or less, you know. There was nothing too traumatic there. But yeah, that's, I think, in a way, in hindsight, being autistic has been very protective for me in the areas that I do struggle, because some I would land into, say, in personal interactions difficulties, but generally overall, although I had a strong sense of I don't actually know what's going on, but also, well, I've got my book, I'm fine. So for the most part, it actually protected me, because I couldn't see maybe if there were people being judgmental towards me reading. Like my sister, at Christmas time a number of years ago, went out to my parents' house, and they were, I can't remember what everyone was celebrating, but I'm not into, like, everyone was bringing like their partners and their boyfriends, some of the boyfriends I'd never met, and I just thought, I'll just bring my book. So I brought some new book that was about the disability history in Ireland. I was like, this is fantastic. So everyone was, I was having a drink as well, but I was like not interested at all, not in a bad way, but like I wasn't going to. Like I had to drive home, so I had to, I don't know, one glass of something, or maybe I didn't actually. No, I didn't. I was driving. I was 7 up, whatever it was. There was something in a glass beside me. I was sitting at the end of mom's counter, and everyone else was like, "No, that is right. I was drinking 7 up." I remember because my sister got a little bit too tipsy. If she listened to the podcast, she'd know which, because I had four sisters. They know which one this was. Somebody got too tipsy anyway, and I was reading the history book. And I remember I hadn't met one of the girls' boyfriends before, because I'm one of 11, so there's much younger sisters than me. And they're like, "Well, hi, my name is," I'm going to call him Paul. "Hi, my name is Paul." I was like, "Hi, Paul." He's like, "What are you reading?" I'm like, "Oh my God, I've got this in Easton's, the history of disability in Ireland." And he's like, "Wow, interesting." I was like, "Yeah, it's so good." And I was like, "Drink my," like, I didn't even bother me that I wasn't. Like, whereas maybe another person might be like, "Oh God, some new people, how will I do the thing?" I'm like, "I'm just going to read my book." So in a way, the thing that made me all my life, the researching, also has protected me, because, and again, because socially I cannot read the room and I cannot read a face in the room, that has also kind of protected me. So in a way, being autistic in the difficult moments of my life has really supported me as well.
Gorgeous to hear. I love that. And I love as well, again, back to that sort of protective bubble, that you were just comfortable being yourself and the rest of the family were like, that's what Amanda does. Amanda is being Amanda. Isn't that great?
And it wasn't, and never has been. Even like my gorgeous sister got married the weekend before last, and everybody knew I wasn't going to go, and it wasn't because I didn't love her and adore her, because I do. It was because for me, the chit chat and the, not with my family, just generally with people in general, like also it was a massive wedding. There was like hundreds and hundreds of people there that I just knew, and that I had to be able to be present as a parent every day after the wedding. And if I went to the wedding, and as much as I'd love to be there, I would not be able to be the mom that my, like Connor, for example, would have high support needs, my eldest son. I needed to be 100% present in my own home every day that I'm here to, for my kids. So there was never a, oh, you won't come to my wedding, because it's actually very known that I don't go to family weddings. I've only been to maybe one out of all of my brothers and sisters so far, and maybe two christenings. I generally don't go, and it's not that I don't love them and adore them. They just know I will just, and I'd be like, you'd say, wow, you'd never know that she struggles or finds this difficult, but I'm masking, and and they understand that I can do it for them, but they don't want me to do that to myself. So they'd rather me not go and do what's best. It's literally one of my sisters, I was chatting to her yesterday, she was saying, no, man, it's really good that you do what's best for you, because she said, you've done so much for all of us that it's really important that you do what's best for you now and look after your health, because you need to be there for yourself and for the kids. And I just thought, how lucky am I? Because I know maybe in other family situations that might not be so welcomed. You know, I don't know, but I know I have been very, very lucky in my own family life in that they're totally fine with me being like, I'm not going to come to your wedding, but have a wonderful day. But then everyone was sending me like videos. I have like videos of my dad walking my sister up the aisle from my sister Claudia sent it to me. And I was like, oh, look at my daddy. And you could see he was nervous. I was like, oh, poor dad. But he still did it. Like, he did great.
And I think that's the thing to remember, isn't it? There are different ways to be involved in things that keep everyone comfortable.
Yes. You know? And nobody would. The only thing my sister said was like, we always give you the readings. I had to do the reading because you weren't there, because like I wouldn't get nervous. I could be like, I'd be like, listen, Father, I'll say a few of the prayers to you. Obviously, I wouldn't. But I just thought it was funny now in hindsight. Do you know that she was like, the only difficulty is that I had to do the big reading because you weren't there. And I was like, look, I'm sure you did us all proud. She's like, oh, but she did. She did brilliant.
And then is there any advice that you'd give to your younger self?
I think what I would say to my younger self, I think be kinder to yourself. I think there's a great thing that when you, not a great thing, I should say, but there's a whole area where when you don't know that you're autistic and you're going up as somebody, but you might have had the sense, I always had a sense that it was different to everybody, but there just wasn't a name. It was just this feeling. I remember I had, and I said this before on a, I was delivering a piece of training for As I Am, and I was saying, like, when I was a child, I used to write this, I used to say this poem everywhere that I, sorry, everywhere in my mind, if I was going out and about, or I'd write it everywhere. And then I used to start writing it in books. And I found a book a number of years ago called, do you remember the book Roll of Thunder, Hear My Cry?
Yes.
I love, I kept that book. It actually belonged to David College. I still have your book. I apologize. So any books I like, you will never get me to give back. Like, I'll buy a replacement. But at the time I was unemployed teenager, I didn't replace the book. I kept it, but I loved it. But when I was moving house here to, I always say my final resting place to my home with the kids, I found that book because I keep all the books in a box I was putting into literally the shed because there's so many books. And a piece of paper fell out of it. And the piece of paper had a poem that I used to write. And it said, and the poem was, here I lie awake. And in this dream, I hope to take a strong way out before I break. Here I lie awake. And the lie piece was L-I-E. And for another person, they might be like, oh, you're lying down. But it was like, I'm lying while I'm awake, but I cannot tell you that I'm not being the person I feel I am. I'm being the person I think you want me to be. So for me, I think if I could give myself a piece of advice, it would be to be kinder to myself. And they don't have to keep trying to be. I always try to be a good person. I'm always trying to be, I don't even want to say a good enough person, be a good person. And that maybe if I'm a good person this time, I can just be myself. But I think the biggest change that has come for me, and if I could tell my younger self this, is that one day you will hear the incredible Adam Harris speak, that one day you will find out about the most wonderful autistic-led organization, As I Am, and you'll meet other autistic people there, and you'll meet people that aren't autistic there that are just the most incredible colleagues and wonderful human beings, and that you will make your friendships there, and you'll meet the incredible Kat Hughes and Peter Vermeulen and all these wonderful people. Because of the wonderful As I Am, we all get to meet each other. It's like the whole, like, it's nearly like a social circle, thanks to Adam and As I Am. We all get to meet all these other incredible autistic people. And suddenly you find your place and you don't have, I used to have the sense of searching. You stop searching and you start saying, you know, I'll say to the young Amanda, one day you'll meet the wonderful Adam Harris. You'll find out about As I Am. You'll learn about what does it mean to identify with other individuals that you see representation, and that suddenly you'll find your place, and your place will be in the autistic community. And then what made you different years ago will now be actually a very much like everybody else. You will still be your authentic self, but there'll be lots of other people like the incredible Kat Hughes that share so many different commonalities with your own lived experience that you just feel like you're home. That's my sense now when I think of, like, As I Am or Adam, or like just sense of safety of, it's okay to be me. It's okay. So just to say to the young me that one day there'll be an As I Am, there'll be an Adam Harris, there'll be a Kat Hughes in the world, there'll be the autistic community in the world where you can just be yourself. And I don't say there's like power in numbers, but you know where you belong, and you belong somewhere. You're not, I always used to, you know, that book Nobody Nowhere by Donald Williams. I remember reading that going, God, what a headline, Nobody Nowhere. That's kind of how I felt. And now I don't feel that way anymore. I know where I belong. I get to talk to wonderful people like yourself. And I live my happy little life in my cottage here in the west of Ireland with my kids, bringing them up to be, you know, Hayley, who's not autistic, and the boys who are to all of them to be their authentic selves. And that's the most important thing, to be that they're happy and safe.
That's really lovely. And then I suppose you are an advocate, you know, and you're a role model for autistic people, very much so. So what was your kind of personal journey to advocacy and sort of then your work with Little Puddins as well?
I think it did always just come back to my kids, really. It was just when Connor was born, and I always feel kind of shame about that, not Connor, but that I didn't understand that there was a whole other world outside of the world that I was existing in. I always say it's like he lifted the veil, that there was a whole other world of, and I don't want to say suffering, but there was people like my son in the world. And I knew they were there because obviously we had neighbours and we had school people that were disabled and different things. But it wasn't something that I was living or supporting. I don't say living with, because obviously it was autistic, but it wasn't something that was part of my everyday life until it was. And then when it was, I remember thinking, my God, you have lived such an enclosed life. Why didn't you look around? Why didn't you see who you could help? Why didn't you ask, like, you love to research, why didn't you find out more about this? Why now? Like, you should have. This is, for me, it was just, I remember thinking, this is, and again, my, for anyone listening, my background is actually that I was training as a solicitor before my son Connor was born. So before I went into this, I suppose, advocacy around autism and disability, I was training as a solicitor, so I always had this. I used to watch Law and Order, I have to be transparent, and be like, I'm going to be a lawyer, like in America. And really random. But again, it was around researching and learning. And again, I did love my role. And again, my key areas I worked in at that time were like probate, family law. So it was always about the person, personal injury. They were kind of my specialisms. And I just remember for me that when Connor was born, and the way people that didn't know Connor personally would speak about him or speak of him while he was there, like he was invisible, it used to kill my heart. And I would just say, this is so wrong. And I remember like the name Little Puddins for my family blog, and that came about where a lady, I was pregnant with Jack actually, Connor had been identified at that point as autistic, and a lady came into the house visiting and brought like lovely crisps and treats for Hayley and Connor, and I was pregnant. Didn't buy me any crisps, I'll just say, I'm joking. But she did come in, and she was really lovely, like, and she was just saying, oh, you know, Hayley, oh, she's such a little puddin, she's such a little puddin. I was like, oh, she's just, and Connor is stimming like in the corner, just so happy having his crisps and so excited, flipping his hands and doing all the lovely things that he loves to do. And she was like, oh, and he's, and I, in my head, a pregnant head, I was like, he's a little puddin too. And she was like, okay, so I'm going to go. And I was just like, oh my God. And then I remember when she left, I started crying. I felt so ashamed that I didn't stick up for Connor and say, he's a little puddin too. But I was so astounded that for this lady, and a nice person all the same, but that she didn't see that it was wrong, that she was not wrong. Maybe I don't want to say wrong, but it was unkind. That she didn't view Connor as the same, not the same, but like as a human being that had thoughts, feelings, emotions that deserved the same title as Little Puddin. And then I just remember saying that, I remember holding Connor, I feel like crying about now, holding Connor and saying, someday Con, I'm going to make the word, if I can, Little Puddin synonymous with every single child in the country, that it's not just this perfect version. And I have, all of my children are that perfect version that you can imagine to be the most perfect human being, but that it won't be just a very distinct version of perfection. It's every human being should have, if they would like to be, maybe as adults who don't want to be, but might be referred to as a little puddin, that it's every person. It's not just this perfection of whatever. And again, perfection is, you know, subjective in what a way, anyway, anyone looks at it. But actually that word, little puddin, recently I was chatting to my sister Claudia, and we were on about different words that, you know, different like colloquial nearly, or like family culture words that people would say. And she's like, do you remember this word and that word? And do you remember dad used to always call us a graw? And I was like, that's love, that's the word for love. And then I think about it, God, I always talk about love all the time. And I'm like, maybe that came from dad as well. And then she was like, do you remember used to call us, ah, you little puddin? And I was like, what? And she goes, do you remember that? And I was like, oh my God, dad did. I can remember, because I'm the older, one of the older sisters. I can distinctly remember him saying it to my younger brothers and sisters. And then I went, imagine, like, I always talk about love and loving each other and being kind to each other, and it all comes from a place of love. And then she was like, dad called us graw, and he called the little ones little puddins. And then I'm like, oh my God, this is like not spooky, but just, it's nearly all connected back in a way to my lovely dad without really thinking of it. Do you know the kind of way? So the advocacy piece then started around then, and then I started Little Puddins when Jack was identified, because when Connor was identified, there was, like, again, there was nothing on the internet, there was horrendous books. Then when Jack was identified, obviously As I Am had started, but I was like, maybe I could do something as a parent. I don't know what I could do, but I could even just share my lived experience as a parent. And that's kind of how it started, and just talking about autism really positively all of the time, because I didn't want to talk about anything negative of being autistic for my children, because I didn't see it as a negative. I saw it as they were just being themselves, and I want them to be themselves, and I want them to, all I wanted to do really was attempt, and maybe I didn't do very well because it's only me on my own, but I attempted to try and maybe possibly change the world for them, because I do realize that one day, as fantastic as I am, I may not always be here. So I want to try and change the world for them before my time is up, whenever that would be, and hopefully not anytime soon, because I need to be here to see them grow old themselves. But for me, it was just, I wanted to change the world for them. And that's kind of how I moved into that area, I suppose, really unintentionally. But maybe the skill set I had as a solicitor or trainee, and then my own thirst for knowledge and research, I tried to try and help in some way in that way.
That's amazing. And very moving, to be honest, to hear that and to hear the, and to think about the difference that people approach or can approach autistic people with.
Yeah.
And the assumptions that they're bringing, and to think that that's something that's inspired what you do, I find incredibly moving.
I just always think that, and my dad will always, he didn't say anything the other day, you always have to think positive. He would always just have said to us growing up, this is exactly what he said. He said, you always have to be careful with your words, because you can never know how they may fall upon a person. and you don't know how they carry those words for the rest of their days. So for me, I'm just, you know, and again, I always stumble over my words because I think so quickly in my mind, I try to catch up with my words. And when I speak, say with mouth words, that I always just think you have to be so careful what you say to yourself. And I'm not the best for like bigging myself up going, you're a great person. But I might just be like, oh, why did you say that? If I said something like, again, social catastrophe. But generally, I always try, if I'm speaking to any other human being, I'm very careful. And it's not that it's contrived, but I'm just always, I always try to think, if you can speak from a place of love, even if someone is not being kind to you or has done something unkind to you or whatever it is, you just don't know. Dad says you don't know what it's like to live in their shoes. Maybe they, you don't know how they showed up in the world today. You don't know. So the only thing you can do is approach the person with kindness. And even if what they've done is horrendous, that you still have to say, I don't want it to disturb my peace. So I'll give forgiveness and I will go back to my life. And that's all you can do.
Lovely. And, but, you know, it's such a shame that autistic people don't understand empathy at all.
Oh, yeah. Because, like, you know, we don't. Literally, I think, and I know this is well known, the autistic, we have such a deep level of empathy. And do you know what? I often think, is it because we've had all experienced in our own ways different levels of trauma because we've been judged or misjudged or excluded or whatever, that I never, ever, ever want to be the person to make another person feel small, to make them feel not good enough, to make them feel anything other than I'm so glad that you've shared whatever it is they've shared with me. Thank you for doing that. Thank you for allowing me to share space with you. I never, God, if I thought that I did something wrong to somebody, I cannot tell you how it would kill my heart. It would kill my heart. And it would kill my heart still for years to come. I'd be like, why did you do that? Like, why? Like, you shouldn't have. Why? And even though it might have been total and utter just social catastrophe, like, didn't read the room, didn't, or just said, if someone asked me a question, I will always be honest and give an honest answer. But maybe I could have crafted the answer. It would play on me for years that why did I do the thing?
Yeah, there are things from my childhood that I said, either meaning them as a joke and not really understanding where banter begins and ends the way that other people seem to, and seeing someone else's reaction to what I've said still.
Yeah, I felt it even when you said it, because I'd have that myself, like where, you know, I can't think of many off the top of my head, but where things, you know, someone asked me a question and I would always just give an honest answer. And then what it transpired now is that not everyone wants an honest answer. People would prefer, I don't say flowery, but like a roundabout answer. But I will always give the answer because, you know, they ask me a question, I'll answer. So what would have happened when I was younger, maybe this is another reason I don't go to weddings, is that if we were going to like family events and things, you know, people would be like, so what do you think? Like one day, I remember, I won't say who, a person at a wedding that's a relative, not my like immediate family, was saying, when I was like a smaller person, probably a teenager, like, oh, do you like my shoes? And I have ginormous feet. I'm a size eight hoofed lady. I have a giant foot. And this person clearly, from my own vision, was also had quite a large foot, or my perception was a large foot. And I said, oh, you have big feet like me. Yeah, they look good. They make your feet look smaller. And the person was not happy with that answer. And I just said, I like purple, because they were purple. And after that, for any other future events, because obviously they must have been trouble about what I said out of my own hearing. After that, then my sister Claudia was enlisted to be close by at weddings. And if anyone was coming up to talk to me, to just mention the word filter, so that before I would reply, I would just pause and think, do they want my honest answer? Would they like a version of my honest answer? So now I would just say, wow, wonderful. That's fantastic. And then I just go, they don't actually want to know. They were just saying, do you like my shoes? And they want you to say yes. So you say yes. But now I just say, wow, lovely. Now I don't say, oh, you too have large feet like me. They don't want to know that. So I know that now. So if you have over the size 8 or over, I would just say, what a wonderful shoe, like my own.
This goes nicely to the next question that I was thinking of. And it's a question that I've had, but it had never occurred to me. And then people started asking me it. Okay. So now I ask other autistic people, because I'm like, is this something I need to worry about? Do you ever worry about putting too much of yourself in your work?
No, I don't, because my thing is, and if anyone, like, and you'd know me as well, that if I speak on anything, I will never tell a lie. So I can only speak authentically, because I suppose if you've lived a life, and I think people that have been identified later in life might identify with this, is that if you've lived a life trying to be the thing you think other people need you to be, and it's not a manipulation, you're just trying, you just can't figure it out. You're like, I said this, that someone said that yesterday, so I said it today, it didn't work out, okay, I'll try something else tomorrow, I'll try, you know, like that whole masking piece and just trying to understand, like being a researcher, I was nearly a researcher in the social world. So for me, when I realized finally that I was autistic, when I finally went forward for that assessment, I just said from that day on, I will only ever be myself. And I can only ever talk from a lived experience perspective. Now I can speak as a parent to autistic kids and things like that. But again, I would be very generalized. Like I wouldn't identify, well, this was a thing with Jack or whatever. I'd be just talking generally. But in my work, I think it adds to the authenticity of the work that we do. And as I am as well, in that, in the work that I would deliver, say on my, on a personal note for myself, that I'm talking from lived experience, that if I'm designing something, I'm designing as an autistic person, because I cannot be contrived in what I say, and I cannot hide what is the truth, because then it's, I you'll always hear me say, I will not lie. I can deliver information in a very, say if somebody asked me a question and it was, say somebody had done something terrible or whatever, and I have to answer a question on it, this is unrelated to work, this is just on a personal level, I will tell the truth, but I will be very conscious of the impact of what I say about whatever it is I'm saying. So for me in my work, then I will always tell the truth. So if I'm delivering a piece on autistic visual thinking, I'll give examples from my own life, because I can speak to that till they pull me off the stage and turn off the mic and stop talking. I'm like, oh, is it finished? And the room is empty. I can talk about it forever because it's the truth. It's my lived experience. But I then, I suppose, like yourself, I'm academic. I'm researching all the time. I'm learning. If you could see what's around me, there's like, I won't even tell you, there's mountains of paper piles. It's like something from Harry Potter. Mountains of papers and books all around me on the floor. But I can bring in then, I think it adds to the presentation for any, even outside of training, just even if a parent asks me a question, I have the knowledge base academically, but I also have the lived experience. And as an autistic person, you can pair the two, as you know yourself, and deliver a really unique but impactful and really powerful presentation. So for me, I don't find it takes from me, it actually adds to me, because every time I talk or speak on autism, it helps me reflect. I'm always saying to Hayley, I'll say, think about it, reflect on whatever it is she's thinking, and come back and we'll chat again. I think that reflective piece is really important for my own self-acceptance and self-understanding, because I spent, say, 39 years not understanding what does it mean to be me, instead of me trying to ask other people what does it mean to be Amanda. Now I'm going, well, that makes sense now. Or even like chatting to my sister yesterday, we're on about different things, like, and I was like, oh God, you know, in hindsight, it's like 2020 vision. So nearly talking about my lived experience to help others actually is very, it's actually very therapeutic, I'd nearly say. So for me, it doesn't take away, it adds to my own self-understanding. And for me, it has meant, and again, also the piece that I cannot read the room, but it means I could talk on autism until the cows come home and never, hopefully, and it could be exceptionally boring on this podcast, but try not to be boring, because it's very authentic all of the time. Do you know the kind of way? So yeah. I think it adds, it supports me in my self-awareness, self-acceptance. And then hopefully, if it's not boring, it might help other people feel engaged in what I'm saying, because it is the truth. It can only ever be the truth. I just have to tell the truth. I cannot. Maybe that's the autisticness of myself. I can only be honest. I could give you a case study, but it won't be as impactful as real life. Do you know the kind of way? I can be like, yeah, here's a case study, but it won't be as impactful as the truth.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's that sort of combination of learning, for me anyway, it's like learning about myself, and sort of as I'm talking about, say, ideas around masking. I gave a lecture at the weekend, and some of it I was talking about masking and then sort of my own experience of masking. And pretty much every time I talk about masking, I come up with a different way that I've masked.
Yes.
And I'm like, oh, that was masking too. So I feel like I'm constantly learning. As I learn about autism, I'm also learning about myself and sort of being able to sort of reframe a lot of the stuff that. Yeah.
I just feel very comfortable in that space of, and I actually just adore listening to other people's lived experience accounts. Like, it's just, I can't think of the right phrase. In my mind, I just see like sparkles in my head. It's just like, you can't, that's the epitome, isn't it? I can't think of it. It comes back to, again, representation, doesn't it? And like, it's also important for ourselves, but also to be the best, to listen to the most perfect ideal information as a parent or as an autistic person. For me, it has to be autistic led. Like, it's the best of the best, but it really is.
And is there any advice that you'd give to yourself as a parent, sort of looking back?
I think I would, if I could go back in time now, I would stop trying to meet the social expectations. This is something I do now that I wish I did then when Connor was small. I would not attempt at any time to meet the social expectations of others. I wouldn't have like the big birthday parties in the house because that was what you were supposed to do for kids. And that was the thing. Whereas my kids would be in the room like, well, when is it over? Even though it was their party. So now, and in the nicest possible way, we have small family parties and it's literally just the kids. And if they'd like to go out to, like, I call them the play centres, like, and they are good fun. But for me, they're just like such overwhelm. But I would go and do the thing because I'm mom and I'll do the thing you want me to do. I will do it for you. And later, I may have a gin when you're all asleep just to be like, oh my God, that was traumatic because it's so loud and just banging and noising and screaming. But I will do the thing for the kids. So for me, outside of that context, I would say to myself as a parent, don't ever try to meet the social expectations. Do what's right for you and your family. So for example, for Hayley's confirmation, at the last minute, we didn't have childcare available on the day, unfortunately. So it was myself and Granny went to the confirmation with Hayley. We didn't bring the boys. Granny and Granda, sorry, were there as well. We didn't bring the boys because I knew it was too much pressure on them. And this day was about Hayley and not against the boys, but I knew they would find it very difficult. And who, as many, including myself, would find it difficult sitting in a church for 2 hours listening to prayers, which are fabulous. But it'd be very difficult for my boys because they love to move around and Connor loves to vocally stim. And I can understand for him, that would be a difficult place. And for Hayley then, I also wanted to make sure she knew that everything was about her that day, as it should be, it was her special day. But then we came home and we had a small party at home and we didn't do the big thing. And instead what we did for Hayley to make sure she still felt very special is that myself and another family member brought her out for a meal in a really fancy restaurant, but it was late at night. And it wasn't actually, it was 7 o'clock in the evening, but she was like, my God, I'm fine dining. It's 7 o'clock. I should be in bed soon. But for her, she was all dressed up in her lovely outfit that she'd had for her confirmation. And like everyone else in the restaurant were adults. So she was like, can I have some wine? I was like, no, you cannot have some wine. You can have a 7-Up. But you know, she was like, well, I just said, as it is my confirmation, I said, come back to me when you're 18 and we'll discuss again. But it was just lovely. Do you know the kind of way? So for me, I don't worry at all now. So another thing during the pandemic, when everybody stopped visiting, obviously, because we had to keep each other safe, we carried that on. Not that we don't allow people into the house, but only very few people come in. So, for example, Granny and Grandas come in, aunties and uncles, and that's it. And obviously nieces and nephews. But if the nieces and nephews are coming, they give us plenty of notice because all of my nieces and nephews, one of the eldest, all my nieces and nephews are very young. So if they're coming, all of like the treasures, the special interest items are up and out of the way while they're here. And then once they are like gone home again after we had the fun, they come out again. So that we all have like our own processes. Whereas like years ago, I'd be like, yeah, come on over. But it's my kids then afterwards that are exhausted or they're upset that someone has moved like a special interest lineup or whatever it is. So my advice to any parent is parent the way that is the best for you and your family. And don't ever consider anyone's judgments on you because this is your house and this is your home and these are your beautiful, gorgeous children. So put them first, put yourself first and leave any expectations or any judgments outside the door and lock your door and be like, goodbye world. Whereas this is, I call home the safe haven. So our house is, you know, I had a friend very luckily about 2 years ago. I was actually in Dublin during autism month. I had to stay for an extra day unexpectedly. And we've never had childcare because it's always just been ourselves and whatnot. And I had to ask my wonderful friend Donna, who wouldn't have taken care of an autistic child before. And she was like, I'll do it. I have no idea what I'm doing, but I'll do whatever you need. I'll do it. And I'll send you updates and I'll send an SOS if I need help. I don't know what I'm doing. But actually, she sent me so many lovely pictures and messages. She was like, Amanda, this is the calmest house I have ever been into in my whole life. Connor is outside on the trampoline. Jack is lining up something. Max is just probably breaking something, but playing over there, doing whatever. They've come to me with like Connor's communication device. Jack was obviously using mouth words then as well, and Max was like echolalia, but again letting her know what he needed. And Hayley was pottering around. She was like, this has been the most peaceful day I have ever had minding a child. She would have, like, obviously his family members would have taken care of and friends as well, kids as well, but she told me that she'd never had an experience like it. There was such a peaceful household. And I just thought, wow, because you live in your own house, you don't know. But it is day to day just very calm. And that's because it's not a rule that I made, but I just was like, this is what's right for my family and I won't ever consider it as a negative. This is what we need. We need that home as the haven. It's an autistic safe space. And for Hayley, that benefits her too, in that if she did have a friend over, there, obviously she can do that. But also just means that she knows for her friend that she tells them ahead of time that the boys are all autistic. And maybe if you see someone lining up, you don't say take something out of the lineup or whatever it is. But outside of that, come and go as you like, because it's just a very peaceful, calm house, thankfully.
Thanks so much for listening to the podcast. If you want to know more about Middletown, you can find us on Twitter @AutismCentre or on Facebook or Instagram @Middletown Centre for Autism.